Now the bosses have been briefed since that time. A good driver must have noticed by looking in the mirror if he's being stalked. Oh, he arrives in the morning before his boss even leaves the building. He takes a little tour of the neighborhood to see if there are any suspicious vehicles. And in the case of Brett, as in the others, the drivers would have seen something unusual and would have reported it to the police. And now I think they are much more aware.
It's an extraordinary story.
We
sometimes talk about thrillers, detective novels, movies.
Bringing Baron was war.
It was pure and simple capitalism.
The bastard finished.
When you kidnap a man, cut off his little finger, and all you want is his money. Well, I don't think it's very glorious.
He's a guy who was respected, even though he had a finger cut off.
He murdered a man. He ruined his life. He mutilated him. So there is no excuse.
He was one of the biggest French bosses, Edouard Jean Ampin. A powerful baron, a flamboyant businessman at the head of the Empin Schneidre Group, a building, chemical, and nuclear empire. 150,000 employees around the world. One morning in 1978, Baron Empin was the victim of a kidnapping against Renan, a fashion phenomenon of the 70s. His captors demanded a colossal sum, 80 million francs. And to prove their determination, they did not hesitate to mutilate him, to cut off a set of his fingers to send to his family. The kidnapping of the Baron? Inbred was a merciless face-off between Thug and Bloodhound from 36 Quai des Orfèvres. A story of money, love, betrayal, hope, and redemption. More than 35 years after this kidnapping, what has become of Edouard Jean-Pin and his captors? What does the Baron think of his friends? What do the police, lawyers, and magistrates think about this case? Iman Gwali and I met up with the protagonists of the Enin affair to analyze with them the consequences and repercussions of this extraordinary case. Yeah.
It was 10:30 p.m. last night when we learned that the Baron had been released by his captors and set free unharmed.
The case began months earlier, on January 23, 1978. That morning, Baron Edouard Jean-Ampin left his opulent building in the 16th arrondissement of Paris. He was sitting in the back of his Peugeot 604, driven by his chauffeur. Suddenly, armed and hooded men emerged from a van in front of stunned witnesses.
They told us that they saw a group of individuals come out, take the Baron by force, and leave in a hurry.
The kidnapping was quick. 45 seconds. Immediately, a police presence was set up. The cars were searched. The city was cordoned off. But Baron Empin and his kidnappers had vanished. Dianin, the Baron's sister, still remembers that day.
How did you learn the news of your brother's kidnapping?
My brother, Edouard Rampin's secretary, called my mother and told her, quote, your son has been kidnapped. I didn't really understand what was happening. I didn't really understand what was happening. I realized it 2 hours later. It was a kidnapping. But why? Why?
Are you worried?
Worried, I think any normal person would be. The first thing you need to do is free the hostage.
The problem is that the hostage is nowhere to be found. His car, the 604, was found a few hours later, abandoned, in a parking lot. Inside, There were no fingerprints, no clues to identify the kidnappers. The police from the Criminal Investigation Department, led by Piero Tavioli, took charge of the case. The case was being followed at the highest levels of government because the money-grubbing baron was no ordinary person.
He was the heir to an enormous fortune. He was also a friend of the President of the Republic at the time, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. He was also part of the Schnidre group, to which the president's wife was also related. Let's just say he was a big fish.
Claude Conte, you were a police commissioner head of section in the Criminal Investigation Department. This kidnapping at the time came after a long series of Ixa kidnappings that would leave their mark on France.
Yes, between the end of December 1975 and August 1977. France and the 1936 that offered them in particular would have to deal with a series of kidnappings, the likes of which France had never seen before, from the Malay affair to the Ravid Bontorov affair and an attempted kidnapping in Perot. All these cases ended happily.
So kidnappings in France and then also kidnappings elsewhere in Europe?
Yes, especially in Italy, where kidnapping with a request for a bribe had become an industry. The Red Brigades, but also the Grand Magistrism.
And what are your first leads after the Baron's kidnapping?
Well, the first leads, in all these cases, we asked the people close to us, the people in the group, the family, and there we are. We are in the fog from the start. Except that we sense quite quickly that Baron Empin, who is the CEO of one of the largest European groups, clearly his environment is not him. So we feel very well that, well, he's gone. He won't come back. It wouldn't be very long, huh?
While the crime intelligence officers explore the first leads, the Baron is being held by his captors. He is being held captive in underground galleries in Louise under a tent in the dark.
Of course, when you're inside the tent and chained up, you don't know what's going on outside. So that avoids any temptation to run away.
Alain Caillot, you are the brains behind this kidnapping. Why did you choose Baron Empin as your target?
Baron Empin was actually a default target because we had made a list of the richest men and women in France, and for various reasons, we eliminated those people.
Who were the other targets?
It was obviously Marcel Dassault.
We eliminated Marcel Dassault.
Why?
Because he had been a Kenvil Poet cell phone. And we were a bit leftist, and we knew that he was at best, well, not at best, but with the Communist Party. And then there was Kilian Betancourt.
And you also gave up on him?
Because of problems like the place where we were going to take him. There were no toilets, no hygiene, none of that. We said to ourselves, we're going to have a problem with a woman. It's going to be complicated.
And how did you get to him?
Through the press. Because at that time, I'm telling you, it was the time when the French Souterie was going down the drain.
We had learned that they had formed bosses, militias, to bring up the unions and strikes. Finally, we said to ourselves, here's the local bastard, this is him.
So what interested you most was the money, but if it...
It was money, but if at the same time, symbolically, we could ransom a nasty capitalist. Well, there you go. It was perfect.
The day after the Baron's kidnapping, Alain Caillot and his accomplices contacted the group's headquarters in a pinch. They demanded that an executive go to the Gare de Lyon to retrieve a message from a locker. There, the police officers accompanying him discovered a ransom demand. 80 million francs, that's more than 20 million euros in today's world. A colossal sum. But there's also a mysterious little package for the family.
In a package wrapped in cotton and the tip of a finger, the end of a little finger. It's reassuring. Because they're gonna cut off your finger to negotiate something. It gives you time. In a situation like that, you immediately fear the worst. So anything that's not the worst is better than the worst.
Why this decision to cut off the Baron's finger?
Our problem is that things are moving very quickly.
And how can they move very quickly? Well, you have to use terror. That is to say, really scare people. And indeed, we found out later when the police received it. And the people in the group's management. Well, they were scared.
It's a means of exerting pressure?
Yeah, it's a means of exerting pressure.
It's nothing more.
Who cares? Is in charge. How did you designate it?
So I always answered that question. It was a collective decision, no matter who did it, because when it came time to do it, to follow the plan, everyone looked at each other and said, well, there was a kind of silence.
What? We said, come on, short straw. Whoever draws the biggest or the smallest, that's the one who does it.
And we did it like that. But it's a collective responsibility.
Would you have done it if it had fallen on you?
Of course, yes.
How did the Baron react?
So the Baron... radio silence. Not a word, not a complaint, nothing.
Old-fashioned Greek.
Stoicism.
We said to ourselves, did you see this guy?
He doesn't say anything. He's holding on.
So is it because he's scared?
Actually, no, that's not it. That's because Baron Empin is like that.
Faced with the determination of the kidnappers, Baron Empin's relatives understood that they had to react quickly. But how to raise 80 million francs? Not easy. Especially since opinions differed on the ransom payment.
There were two different attitudes between the family and the group. The group wanted to pay the ransom in order to try to outwit us. That was clear. And then the family was convinced by Piero Tavioli that they absolutely mustn't pay a ransom because they were not at all sure of finding the hostage. And then, if you want, they had to put an end to this kind of business because, as I said, 15 is a lot.
However, despite the police's instructions not to pay a ransom, secret negotiations began between the Empin group and the kidnappers.
We had asked for a sum and they offered us half. Okay, we refused because
we decided it was time and not half.
And why did you refuse? It was still a substantial sum.
Yes, but because we had asked for it.
We have
40 million francs.
Yes, but we told them on the phone, we don't sell carpets. It's 80. There you go.
Are you playing with the nerves of the family and the police, or is this the reality?
Yeah. No, but we don't want to. But wait, we don't do that. We don't play, we play for nothing at all. If they pay there, if instead of 40, they bring 80, he's released the next day. There you go.
In the meantime, the police, who have no clue about the kidnappers, decide to explore the only lead they have left, the Bread Baron himself. And he discovers the man's secret life, a poker player, and a regular at casinos. He lost 11 million francs gambling. Did a disgruntled creditor seek revenge by kidnapping the Baron? Or did the Baron have himself kidnapped to wipe the slate clean?
Since it was discovered that he was a gambler, well, we think of the folklore of the severed finger among cheats. That's when we really started digging a lot. But it didn't bring us much.
The image of the Great Baron cracked a little more when the press revealed that the gambler was also a womanizer. His infidelities were spread across the front pages of the newspapers. The family, holed up in their headquarters on Avenue Fauchet, was harassed by the press.
We were terrified to see what would
come out in the headlines because it hurt us. We did see that the press at 33 Avenue Fauché had a stethoscope pass through a chimney to listen to what was being discussed in the apartment. So things have gone very, very far concerning the press.
Time passes, the investigation is stalling, and the 8 kidnappers of the Baron are starting to lose patience.
It's true that we targeted the wrong person in terms of cash and personal wealth. We were wrong. We were wrong about that.
And then there's weariness.
There's a part of the team that says, yeah, but I haven't seen my kids for 3 days. My car got hit. I have to get the red light changed. I can't keep the day after tomorrow. My wife's going to the hairdresser. Anyway, you want to kill some things, and that ruins your mood. You want to end it all.
You come to vote for his death at some point?
Of course, because then we either release him or we kill him. We kill him as an example, we get someone else, and then it's easy. That's the question. It came up, and so... Yeah, so-and-so, he's a bastard. We have to kill him. B, the other guy. No, we can't do that anyway. He didn't do anything to us. Plus, he's nice. So vote. Four yes, four no. Vote again. And yes, and three no. I voted for his death.
I told
him. You voted for his death?
Yeah. Now, killing him no more than mutilating him, frankly, that wouldn't have been fun, huh? It wasn't. But in fact, in any case, I would have done it.
You were ready to do it.
If it falls on me, we do it. Then we would have decided who would do it. And there you have it. It would have fallen on someone. But if that's not the goal, we don't want to kill anyone.
Today, are you happy to have let him live his life in peace?
Of course. Of course. Once again, he's never prepared for it.
You happy not to have killed him? But for you or for him?
But for him, for me.
2 months go by like this, when the Baron's kidnappers set a meeting to pay the ransom to the representative of the Empin Group. Thursday, March 23, 3 p.m. at Faux Champs-Élysées. But it's the police who take matters into their own hands. Inspector Maieri, nicknamed the Chinese, poses as the ransom bearer, a fake ransom, of course. Then, an interminable treasure hunt takes the policeman from one cafe to another, from a message at the bottom of a trash can to the next bistro.
Well, we get going. They could intercept me at any moment. We have to plan for a brutal handover, an interception during the journey, and not necessarily a smooth handover at a meeting place.
This little game of cat and mouse lasts several hours. He is escorted from a distance by his colleagues from the Research and Intervention Brigade, the anti-gang unit. Robert Brood, at the time, you were the deputy head of the B of the BRI. How did you set up the team that would protect Jean-Mazier Massier, the one who had to hand over the ransom?
It was very cumbersome. It was very cumbersome. Let's say that I had about 20, 25 guys from the VRI with me. There were people who were at motorcycles, vehicles, vans, all sorts of different vehicles, completely unmarked, with completely unmarked outfits where we had to pretend not to know each other. Nog was really trained in this work of tailing and surveillance, but it's extraordinarily tiring from a nervous point of view. You're saying.
What are the risks of such an operation?
Well, the first risks are getting noticed by the hostage takers. Obviously, when they make you do a whole route, you position yourself in certain places to see if the ransom bearer is being followed or not.
Yeah. So it's a game of cat and mouse, but...
Continuously.
Yeah, but you don't have control.
Ah, there you have it. We're here. We're faced with a fait accompli, a bit of the route. We don't know in advance. And above all, I apologize for the term, but we see suspects everywhere.
Yeah.
But all this is, I was going to say, extremely nerve-wracking because you're not sure of nothing. There you have it.
The treasure hunt lasts 2 days. The police and kidnappers are at their wits' end. The last stop is the A6 motorway. The kidnappers arranged to meet the Chinese near the B16 telephone terminal, south of Paris. Inspector Eric Young is in the front row. He is then an anti-gang police officer in charge of protecting Masir, aka the Chinese man, who parks near the telephone terminal.
The Chinese man gets out, but at that moment, all at the same time, we see two hooded men emerge, like they are coming out of the ground on one side, holding grenades, on the other side, holding a submachine gun, and they go through the tunnel leading to the B-16 terminal.
We rush like crazy down the slope. We get into our car and leave. We drive 4 kilometers at full speed.
Alan Call and his accomplice arrive at the noise barrier of the Ellerose, pursued by the police from the crime and the old town.
That's when everything changed. Why?
Because at the very top of the highway wall, there was an intruder with a submachine gun, and he opened fire, and it was a gunfight like I'd never seen before. And it was going off everywhere.
In those few seconds, my friend got shot in the back through the door. I raised my hands, and they kept shooting, so I got shot twice in the arm. Of course, then the cops arrived, took my friend out, and he died there. And I was naked, completely naked.
There was, I would almost say, the smell of black powder and blood flowing. And I rushed towards the man who was on the ground. I took my gun, I cocked the hammer, and with the hammer cocked, I put my revolver in his mouth. And while threatening to kill him, if he didn't tell us where the Baron was, I said to him, "Have you seen your friend? He's dead.
Mm-hmm.
He's been killed.
If you don't tell us where he is, I'll kill you."
And the person on the ground, the thug on the ground, looks me straight in the eye and doesn't say anything. Obviously, I wasn't gonna kill him.
Alan Caillot is the only lead you can use to find the Baron. Caillot absolutely has to talk. How's that gonna happen?
Caillot, who's an intelligent guy, understood very well that the investigation was at such a point that the Baron had to be released.
Yep.
However, his big concern was that he knew that George Bertoncini was among the kidnappers. Oi. What Alan Caillot feared was that Bertoncini, in order to avenge his friend from the castle who had been killed during the arrest, would kill the Baron. At that moment, Mouet, and he said to Ottavioli, "I'm ready to call to have the Baron released like a loaf of bread." Ottavioli told him, "You have a phone there on his desk, and I can see the scene again as if it were yesterday." He picks up the phone, brings it closer like this, hides the receiver, and dials the number.
I think I can say word for word what he said. "Freeing the Baron means war." Alain Kale's phone call will pay off. After 63 days of captivity, the Baron of Bread is finally freed.
For me, it was miraculous. The work that the criminal had done was magnificent. He was free. Now, respect. He only asked for one thing: to go home, see his dog, his wife, his children, and say, "I am free."
Jean-Edouard Empin is free, but stunned and extremely disappointed by the reception he has received. Because in the meantime, the press revelations about his escapades have tarnished his image. His wife and his colleagues have turned their backs on him.
I had been in crazy dreams. Imagine that when I was going to come back, it would be the return of Monte Cristo. There will be people on the balcony. Everyone will be there with the bottle of champagne. The thingamajig.
Yay.
How do we get there? I mean, I had imagined a party, and I see that everyone has a frightened expression. I mean, it's a suspicion and so on. What happened?
You're going to have to explain
yourself.
You're going to have to do this.
You're going to have to explain, soldier.
No, but explain what?
Police side, After the Baron's return, the investigation progressed quickly. A good part of the gang of kidnappers was arrested in the months later. 8 people in all, 6 men and 2 women. 4 years later, on December 2, 1982, the trial opened. The star of the hearing was the Baron. His testimony at the bar left a lasting impression.
He recounted the events exactly as they happened. And it was probably the most serious indictment he could make against them. Without hatred, without exaggeration, without giving a romantic touch to something that had none. And here he had an attitude where he truly rehabilitated himself.
Dato.
If rehabilitation was to happen, that's perhaps not the right word, but he shifted his image towards a positive aspect.
No hatred or desire for revenge. The Baron forgave his captors. After 3 weeks of hearings, the prison sentences range from 5 to 20 years. 20 years was the sentence given to Alain Caillol, who had been defended at the time by a tenor future minister, George Quigman.
I had the naivete to think that wherever I went, the severity had long since passed. Or, well, no, she was still sentenced to 20 years, which was not insignificant.
Today, 37 years after the kidnapping of the Baron and Bread, this case remains unique because it is the only kidnapping where the return proved more difficult for the prisoner than his captivity. However, just a few days after his release, the Baron planned to resume his life as before.
I asked him, but Mr. Baron, how will it be for you now, especially since he had suffered so much with an extraordinary smile?
He looked at me and said, but you know, it won't change anything for me. You know, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and things will fade away, time will pass, and I will continue to live as I lived before. And that left me. I said, this can't be possible. This can't be possible. And it wasn't me who was wrong. It was the Baron and Bread.
After his return, the Baron and Bread went into hiding for 8 months away from home, wanting to unwind and rebuild himself.
He went to the United States with one of his old childhood friends, and then he came back to Fran and said, I'm taking over the management of the business.
But the flamboyant Baron had lost his splendor, and his legitimacy was being challenged at the head of his own group.
The fact that I was there created what I call a draw for many people. Some wanted to take my place. Others wanted to take the place of those who were taking my place. And that is to say that the entire hierarchy that wanted to move up a notch, the Baron had to not come back. What was going to happen? Everyone had to move down a notch.
The Baron is pushed out as a result of a kidnapping in which he is only the victim.
That moment you realized the harm you had done to this man, not only physically, but also psychologically and socially.
Right.
Well, yes, because I had the newspapers. The newspapers?
Well,
yes, in fact, we killed him there.
He was destroyed.
Did you destroy him?
Yes.
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 Of course. We destroyed him without a wolf?
Of course.
We ruined his professional life? And maybe part of his social life?
Yes.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, today,
to him.
There you go.
In 1981, the Baron sold his shares in his group. The all-powerful heir started from scratch.
A kind of rage seized him, and all of a sudden he decided to live for himself, so to speak. Outside of the character that had been created for him up until then.
The former captain of industry then became a small business owner. He started importing and exporting aeronautical equipment. and real estate.
Oh, he learned that managing the cash flow of a small business was difficult, that you had to be careful with the group on Rue d'Anjou. D'Anjou? Well, it was something quite unimaginable. But frankly, he did well.
The Baron would never find success in business again. He was even tried for bankruptcy in 1998.
He was acquitted of the bankruptcy he was accused of. But it wasn't easy, indeed.
Not easy either, on the family side. The revelations in the press had a negative impact. His marriage was falling apart.
In any case, I was described as a sort of socialite or barely a honest gambler with dubious connections who played poker games in backroom gambling dens. My wife didn't tell me, but she made it clear to me that... my children couldn't have a father like that. He divorced Princess Silvana, who was his wife, and with whom he had children. They had both been very much in love with each other before, but the revelation of a certain number of things meant that it was no longer possible.
The Baron.
And the case remains emblematic in the history of the police. It left its mark on the history of 36 Rois de Fèvre. First of all, because it was the longest kidnapping ever known in France, but also because the police's strategy of firmness paid off. Pierre Violi, the head of the Criminal Investigation Department, had decided on his own not to pay the ransom.
Claude Canès, why decide in a kidnapping case that there will be no ransom payment?
Simply because Pierre Ottavioli understood that if we gave in just once to the kidnapper, to these big thugs, it was over. We would no longer control anything, and he often said it to Ottavioli, thugs have no objective. Money, the approach of renunciation, will make them commit recklessness.
And at the same time, it is a bit easy for the police to say, we will not pay, but the police also take the risk of endangering the life of the hostage.
Yes, of course, of course, of course. It is a risk. It is a risk, but one that Ottavioli took, and once again, that he took all by himself. Because when we say that he is administrative and therefore political and judicial hierarchy, Drahe agreed with his strategy. It was an agreement. But come on, let's be clear, students.
After a long series of kidnappings in the 70s, Edouard Jean Impin was the last boss to be kidnapped. The last one in the territory of the Parisian Criminal Investigation Department. Because after him, two other bosses were kidnapped in France.
There was the kidnapping of Henri Lelièvre, a billionaire banker who lived in Sarthe and who one day saw police officers arrive at his home who turned out to be fake police officers because it was Maître Fekane. He had asked for 6 million francs, which he got. And then the other kidnapping that is a bit similar is Jacques Hivert, who was a small-time crook who kidnapped the CEO of a big-time killing spree, La Riviere, in Charles. Now we go down even further and ask them for 3 million francs.
Michel Maurice La Riviere was released without ransom before his kidnapper, Jacques Hivert, was arrested and sentenced to 20 years in prison. As for Jacques Morin, he didn't enjoy his ransom for long. 3 months later, he was shot dead by the police at Port de Clignancourt. The police won each time, even though at the time, they were working with methods that today might seem completely outdated.
We had unmarked vehicles that were very easy to spot, and Stukwells that were quite unreliable. Now, with cell phones, beacons, and GPS, it would be much easier. Back then, we used small maps of the suburbs that we had in our hands. It was still quite complicated.
Especially since in a kidnapping case, the first few hours are crucial. In the late 70s, searching for information on the victim was not what it is today.
Today, you can go online and on the net, You will find this gentleman's entire resume, photos, addresses, his connections, and his group. You can search the group, and in just a few minutes, you have a wealth of information. Back then, we had an old WVO in the office of the director of the PJ, three floors below. Otherwise, we had to send a team to the family to try to find out a bit more. We would send a team to the company, call the General Intelligence Services and the DST, and we would get the same information as on the internet. But in half a day...
If the kidnapping of the Baron in Pinsas happened today, how would we proceed technically at the forensic level?
Well, I think part of the group would be identified fairly quickly.
Why?
Because in the abandoned vehicles, the stewardesses stole the Baron's car. The forensic technicians found small hairs, traces on which DNA could be found, and traces of a little papillary traces. And since all these people were known and on file, we would have certainly identified several members of the gang fairly quickly.
What other way?
The cameras? In Paris, there were no cameras in Paris at the time. Now I can tell you that we would have certainly seen the route of part of the convoy. We would have identified certain members of the bank more quickly, which does not mean that we would have arrested them immediately. That's a whole different ballgame. But it would have already led us down an interesting path.
Would it be as easy today to kidnap a boss as it was when the Baron was kidnapped?
Much more difficult.
Why?
Now the bosses have been briefed since that time. There are not only official services, I'm thinking of the DGSI, the former DC, DST, and so on, and even private companies that go into companies to give advice not only to bosses but also to drivers to ensure that they have their intentions awakened.
A good driver should realize by looking in the mirror if he's being spied on. He arrives in the morning before his boss even leaves the building. He takes a little tour of the neighborhood to see if there are any suspicious vehicles, and in the case of Payne, as in the others, the drivers would have seen something unusual and would have reported it to the police, and now I think they are much more aware.
On the kidnapper's side, 37 years after the Baron's abduction, the ranks have thinned out. Alain Caillot is one of the only survivors.
Died of old age, illness, and banditry.
There you have it, they're dead.
So years in the closet.
Poverty, illness, and old age were not pleasant.
Among the missing was George Bertoncini, a pimp and trafficker from Marseille who had been sentenced to 15 years in prison for kidnapping the Baron. Released in 1989, he relapsed 5 years later for trafficking cocaine between France and Colombia. He died in prison in 2001. But the justice system did not judge all of the kidnappers of the Baron, because three of them escaped prosecution. One of them, still alive, is living a peaceful life. K.O. did not rat him out.
I'm not going to ask you his name?
No. Anyway, it's out of date. He's a survivor, and he's a guy who has no criminal record.
Who never had one.
Who never had one, and who after that started his life over. There you go. He had a period. He was very young. A bit hot. He was very lucky. There you go. There are people who are thrown out of the plane before he spits out. What? There you go. And then the guy was thrown out of the plane.
And how did he slip through the net?
He wasn't identified.
And no one gave him his name.
And no one gave him his name. There you go.
And what is he doing today?
Well, today he works abroad. He's doing well.
Alain Caillot was released in 1989 after 11 years in prison. 11 years during which he became interested in literature. He then published a book on George Sand's correspondence written in prison. This new career as a writer allowed him to cross paths with an old acquaintance again. The policeman who put the barrel of his gun in his mouth to make him confess.
15 years later, after he had served his sentence, here he is, writing a book that I left the police, and I am a journalist at France Inter,
and who is going to be my guest on a recorded show.
During this show, Elaine Kyle does not recognize Eric Young, the cop-turned-journalist.
At the end, I say to him, Mr. Kyle, we both know each other. He says, oh, really, we know each other? B says to him, yes, you even mentioned me in your book, page 103. And then I see Kyle's face change. He says, but that's not possible. You're not the cop who I say yes, but he says, but it's you. I say, yes, but you wrote in your book. I knew he wouldn't have shot.
And how did you tell him?
He told me because I saw it in your eyes. And since then, I have maintained
special
relations. Not the right word, but good relations with a Lucayo whom I see regularly.
After a few years of a quiet life, Elaine Kyle also fell back into cocaine trafficking in 2001. It is definitely not easy to settle down.
I would say that I am annoyed to see that Kyle has fallen back into it. It is a bit of a shame that in the end he never saw any other way of achieving his ambitions than to fall into crime. Because deep down, I would have liked to see Kyle as a university lecturer who was a bit too inclined to look favorably on his students and lead a kind of dandy life. There is no cruelty with Kyle when he plays tough. He forces himself a bit.
The robber, who loved literature, served another 5 years in prison and was released in 2009. 3 years later, he published his second book, Lumiere. This is the title of his truth about the kidnapping of the Bread Baron.
I wanted to ask him for forgiveness collectively on behalf of everyone. Just as he did. Because generally, people who are criminals, who have victims, they do it and then they don't care. I was sorry. Sorry that it happened to him. Sorry that his life was ruined. There you go. What else do you want me to tell him? I'm sorry. What is true?
In your book, you talked about reverse Stockholm syndrome. What do you mean by that?
That is to say, as time went by, you were in a tent and someone gave you something to eat, someone to drink, a cigarette, and then you had secret relationships. And then you talked, played tennis, skied, went clubbing, and picked up chicks. And in fact, you represented the ideal of the guys who were there. Anum puro. To be young, to be handsome, to be rich. That's all you wanted.
Everything we all wanted.
So with respect, there was a kind of admiration, like people who admire movie stars.
You met the Baron in Bread when your book came out. It was an emotional moment.
When I saw him again. Oh yes, of course. So if you want an anecdote, when we took him in and I read him or gave him our conditions, I addressed him. Informally, from the start. And I always addressed him informally when he was in detention. Today I can't manage to address him formally. I can't. So when you were talking about respect, that must be it. I can't manage to address him formally. He's a kind of Lord of Bread because he'll never reproach you for anything. He's above that. He's the kind of guy who does that. He's impressive.
Diane Enpin, what do you think of Elan Kyle's apologies to your brother? I have no excuses. For me, he hurt a man. He ruined his life. He mutilated him. So there's no excuse. He changed families. So I don't know. Silence breeds contempt. Do you regret it today?
I don't regret anything I did at all. The question is, if you could start your life over again, would you do the same thing? There you go.
Actually, if I had to do it all over again.
Oh, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't commit crime or banditry today. Because today, I know things that I didn't know. But, I accept my life as it has been.
How do you live today?
Books, the internet, a little theater, and that's it. Cinema.
What kind of life do you think of?
Perfect. Perfect. I'm a stupid little retiree. I'm not what I would have liked or wanted to be, and that's how it is.
A quiet retiree.
Quiet. Yes, quiet. What does quiet mean? I say, I'm no longer a criminal. That's it, if that's what you mean.
The Brett affair caused a lot of trouble at the time of the events. It aroused passions and remains anchored in the criminal memory of the French.
We must have all the weapons on our side.
A memory revived in 2009 when director Lucas Belloux brought to the screen an adaptation largely inspired by the kidnapping of the Baron in the email. Ah! The script closely resembles the case, but it is a contemporary transposition. The main character played by Ivan Atal is called Stanislas Grof.
Lucas Belloux, why did you decide to adapt this story for the cinema?
Because at the time of the kidnapping, I was quite young. I was a teenager, and in the end, I took it a little lightly, thinking, yeah, in the end, a big boss, exploiter, and so on. He got what he deserved. And when I saw the Baron telling his story again, telling the story of his captivity, I said to myself, what this man went through is appalling. You can't do that to anyone. So I said to myself, we have to make a film to show what it's like to be in captivity like this, and to show that a man, no matter who he is a man.
What did you really want to bring out in your film?
The impending suffering at all times, his strength and dignity, certainly, and the abomination that a story like that represents, catching a man, and in the hours that follow, cutting off his finger before even speaking to him, practically like that. And then there you have it, he's a man reduced to the state of an animal and yet another mistreated animal.
So we had to talk about that.
Yes.
What of you? Do you have of the kidnappers in your film?
An extremely hard view? It's just guys who decide to make money and who are ready to kill an individual to chain him up. I am extremely harsh.
The Baron publicly declared that he enjoyed the film. Did it touch you?
Yes, it touched me because it was, I felt like, a great responsibility to tell the story of someone who was still alive, which was an extremely difficult, extremely intimate story. If he had not found his way into it, if he had felt betrayed or sullied or mistreated, it would have been an additional torture in a way. And I didn't want that. I made the film precisely not to rehabilitate him, but in any case to say this man was not guilty of anything.
Today, Baron Empin is 77 years old. He divides his time between the Paris region and Monaco. Remarried, grandfather and great-grandfather, he has rebuilt himself and is enjoying his second life.
Diane Empin, how is brother doing today?
Today, what saved us in all these events is that we have always kept a certain sense of humor. It is our upbringing, perhaps also our star, laughter. And sharing.
So today, he is doing well.
It has given him more authenticity. He has become more accessible, more human, more relatable. I remember a press conference he gave shortly after his release where he said, I realized that happiness consists of getting up in the morning, having a good coffee, taking a shower, kissing your loved ones, and going to work. At this point, I think it is about redirecting people towards a fairly simple form of happiness.
Simple joys like hunting or vacations in the mountains.
He has friends who have remained loyal to him. You know, it is also useful. When you have been to the Pantheon and then become an ordinary man again, you measure also the quality of his friends, his true friends.
Would you say that today he is a peaceful man? In a family context, he is at peace. He has found his children. He is loved, warm, happy, laughing. So he is at peace.
Today, the Baron is working on a film project retracing the industrial saga of the Empen family to leave another mark on history than his memories that stick to his skin as the kidnapped and mutilated Baron, and to definitively turn the page on his former life that he no longer wants to talk about.